Hello, I'm Peter Ayers, and you're listening to Stages, the podcast that converses...
The reality of that 8-show a week slog is really hard.
When I start on a character, I have to draw them, and I'm not an artist.
This is an effect built in myth and mystery.
So you'd be sitting in this tiny little bio box with radiators all around you.
Which was a funny thing, because I don't think that play would have happened in that way if it wasn't at Griffin.
You're a bit different to the other girls in this area.
Yes, I thought, yes, I am.
That was the days when they could smell an actor or a singer and think, oh, I've got 6 weeks.
My sisters really taught me that I had to be versatile.
This ostrich, pink ostrich feather sticking up out of my hair, out of this wig.
My first career, as it were, was preparation for my second career.
And her face was beaming. It was just beaming at me.
I hadn't lost any of my passion or love for it, so it's been a joy to talk to you. Thank you very much.
Hello, I'm Peter Ayers. Welcome back to Stages, or if you're a first-time listener, welcome to Stages, the podcast that converses with creatives about craft and career. Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart's The Magic Flute will be presented by Opera Australia during their summer season in early 2024. At the helm of the production is director Kate Gall, an artist of tremendous invention and imagination. The production is bound to thrill as this operatic staple is brought to vivid life. Assisting Kate as movement director is frequent collaborator Andy Dexterity. His eclectic style and command of the physical always delights and sheds enlightening perspective. Both were guests in early seasons of the Stages podcast. It was a treat to catch up with them once again to hear what's been happening in their worlds and what we can look forward to in the world of the magic flute.
But it's actually quite good to unlock the characters from something that's less precious into something that's a little bit more... bold, which I think is what we want, and then they can make it their own. So I would say that's a
The audiences will subconsciously.
Do you two mind not having a production meeting at the moment?
Fine. No, this is not that.
We like to take every moment to make sure we are discussing the magic flute.
Yes, well, as soon as you both walked in the door, you were chatting flute.
she started it.
Kate Gall and Andy Dexterity, how lovely to have you at my dining room table.
Isn't it?
Croissants
just?
And coffee on a Saturday morning as we discuss all things art and craft in your worlds. And of course, getting around to the magic flute, which Kate is directing and Andy is the movement director for Opera Australia's magic flute.
Yes, summer season 2024.
Very exciting, very exciting. But first of all, look, how nice to chat to you again, because you were guests. Kate, you were in the very first season of the Stages podcast, and Andy, you were in the second season. Mm. In fact, Kate was August 2018, and Andy was April 2019.
I remember it well.
Do you? Okay. What do you remember about it?
Oh, the champagne was flowing.
We did have champagne. Now you're having coffee.
I know. Mm. We had wine. We had some rosé, I think. Gosh, I still remember. That was a highlight of 2018.
We moved into our matinee era.
Yes.
Social lubrication. Mm.
Yeah. I'm going to give my moustache a blue rinse.
Well, you were about to head off to America. On a big adventure when we chatted.
Very different world then.
Yeah, that was pre-COVID and all sorts of things.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. How was the American experience for you?
It was very unexpected. Arrived and was very shocked that Hollywood was actually a mirage. A city built in the desert, and everything is fabricated. So you quickly realize that it becomes your responsibility to keep up the illusion of city and the megaphone of ideas to the world. And it's a non-stop hustle. I went from having one job here at a time in Sydney to juggling 6 jobs at once and still trying to keep on top of rent along with life and then COVID and then, the rest of it.
It's a tough existence for an artist anywhere, really, but I imagine... Hollywood, LA would certainly be magnify that.
The sheer amount of projects at once is very thrilling, because there's always hundreds of movies being made at once, and you're bouncing from music videos to pop-up events on rooftops, and you become a bigger creative because you just have to say yes to everything. Do you want to build a set? Of course I do. Do you know how to do it? Of course I do. And you just figure it out because you're surrounded by so many very talented people condensed in one spot. And because it was pandemic, we were all sharing skills with each other just to survive. I had editors, directors, set designers all in my apartment complex. And so we were making our own content in our building to get by. It was, yeah, it's very stressful, but very rewarding.
Part of your creative genius is using Auslan in your dance expression and choreography. Were you able to tap into that, those skills?
Yes, I mean, I started out sharing Auslan with America. They're two different sign languages. And I started developing my American Sign Language skills as well. So I became multilingual in a physical sense, which gave me the ability to find a more universal language with movement and find similarities and differences. And so I got to use that in the context of music videos, giving singers and musicians physicality that spoke on a global level. So that was really thrilling for me, because I think it's a different approach to movement direction, other than being like abstract pretty movement. It really speaks to people who live with those shapes, you know. And so, yeah, I'm excited for the future of music videos in that sense.
Well, you certainly kept us very entertained through all of your socials during COVID, Instagram and Facebook.
Yeah, when your bedroom turns into a nightclub or a theatre, you've got your props all lined up on the bed and mum's knocking on the door going, it's 2 a.m. and you're about to set off a glitter confetti into the carpet that she's going to vacuum up for the next 2 weeks. Yeah, but it was a very strange way to make money. Yeah.
And Kate, you, of course, have been extraordinarily busy, continue to be busy with any number of productions. You were very graciously let Stages profile the development of your The End of Winter and camp recently for the Pride Festival, which was a lot of fun. But what have you been up to since 2018?
I can't even remember when that was, Peter. look, always, I like to pride myself on the fact that I work at both ends of the theatrical spectrum. So I love working with independent artists as a director or as a producer. I've been working with Clockfire Theatre. They're a physical theatre company who work in a very European Jacques Lecoq style. It's been really fun getting them into, I guess, opportunities where they can really be their best. And then also working at the other end, say, in opera. So I've done quite a few things with Opera Australia. But this, of course, The Magic Flute, will be my first original production, which is really exciting.
Very exciting. You're an artist too who invests wholly in knowing what's happening around the world as well as on the domestic scene. And you've informed a lot of us in recent times about the latest simulcast that, you know, you've got up at 3 a.m. to watch, or you'd been overseas travelling and you caught various productions and learned about new companies and artists and all that sort of thing. So that's been a great thrill for all of us to sort of be guided by your lessons.
Thanks, Peter. I think one of the real benefits of COVID were the digital release of those productions that we would normally have waited sometimes decades for them to come to Australia or have to travel to Europe or America to see them. I know there's lots of debate about filmed theatre, but it's a great way to educate yourselves on, I guess, different plays, different modes of performance, different directors, literally things I would never have seen were coming to us via the generosity of these fantastic companies. So I think that's great. And I think now we have a very different view of how we document our work for that sort of dissemination. But yes, look, I've been extremely fortunate.
Filming has got a lot better though, hasn't it?
It has. I mean, the digital age. The cameras are tiny. I mean, the Met Opera, I think, was the real they really initiated this idea. And obviously they had a lot more resources. They have a much bigger stage. And I guess where the cameras sit on the stage and on the edge of the stage, because you're getting these fantastic cinematic close-ups. And then, of course, the National Theatre in London does something very similar. I mean, the quality of the recording and just the intimacy of the work is so thrilling to watch. I mean, Of course, it's very different when we all sit together in the dark and watch them together. You can't replace that. But how accessible have all these great productions become now? Mm. And the fact that you really, really can see operas from around the world, we just don't have enough access to all of that work without this.
Geographically, you can't see everything.
You can't. So no, you great. Absolutely can't. You can't watch all the stuff that's coming out on video either, but you can have a good stab at it, you know?
And likewise, you know, Australian Theatre Live is filming local production be accessible, well, all around the nation, but hopefully overseas as well.
Yeah, I think that will grow. Yes, absolutely.
And also, since coming back from America and the notice of Magic Flute on the horizon, in my circles, I mentioned the Opera House, and a lot of people haven't even stepped inside the building. There are people who have never seen operas. There are people who don't even go to the theatre, and their only experience of it is online, should it be through an advert or a streaming service. And the fact that, you know, the camera becomes their lens to experience it, it's really exciting that they're getting a true representation of the artist's vision as opposed to a static camera up the back, that's really exciting, especially
and sound recording is good. The sound recording is great. You know, the big problem in the old days with the video camera up the back was you could never capture the sound.
Mm.
And as we know with anything, it doesn't matter how wobbly the pictures are, the sound always has to be brilliant.
Yep.
And now, of course, you can get great sound in the theatre, which is a real plus.
Yeah. Mm. Andy, can you tell us a bit about Gloria? This is a new venture that you've embarked on.
Gloria.
I have got that right, haven't I? That's the name of your beautifully crafted... you describe
Gloria is a presence, and she is revealing herself to us. She first appeared at Christmas when Grandma was drunk one year, and there was a song called Gloria that came on. You might know it, Gloria.
It's Gloria, Gloria.
Yeah.
Da, 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 da.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think of the singer's name.
Oh, I always have to search.
Lanigan. Laura Lanigan. No, Laura Flanagan.
Definitely Laura, isn't it?
Laura. Kate would. Will look it up while we're chatting.
Yeah, and so...
Brannigan.
Oh, yes. Laura that Brannigan. Feels right. Yeah. And my grandma was a knitter, so it was always peach schnapps and yarn. And she set this precedent of joy. And when I was living in LA, well, I started knitting when I was working in musical theatre in Melbourne, and it was cold, and her Madge down there didn't have heating at the time. And we were doing hair, which, of course, has a nude scene, so we were very cold a lot. And so that's when I started learning knitting. And so from drunk grandma to working in musical theatre, the yarn started to take on a personality. And when I was living in LA and the pandemic hit, and you have to find ways to pay rent because the TV commercial and the music video and the pop-up didn't pay you enough, I know how to knit. And so in the eternal summer city of LA, walking around in shorts and thongs, I'm going to knit. This is all I got. And I thought I'd just give it a go. And I started posting these knitwear pieces online. And it was really exciting, people's response to it, that I did manage to start selling them to make some dough and send them all over the world to countries that were cold from a summer city. And so Gloria started spreading her threads globally. Basically, she saved my life at the time because homeless rates were going up so fast in LA. All the parks were being filled with families in tents. And, you know, just walking home, I'd see them and think, it's so easy to just end up there in places like that with a medical bill, or, you know, you just can't keep up. And Gloria afforded me a ticket back to Australia at a very tight time when I heard that the writer's strike was coming. And I thought, I can't be here for that. I need to be with family and I need to be somewhere that feels safe. And so, yeah, Gloria took me home, and now she's getting arty. She's jumped on board the Opera House train, and she started making some lovely Utzon-inspired pieces. She's coming along for the ride. It's getting a bit warm here in Sydney, so Gloria's discovered silk and sequins and some cooler fabrics for the body. But yeah, if you're too hot, you can stick a Gloria on the wall. On the couch.
Oh, an art piece as well, or a throw.
It could be a throw.
Yeah. But sort of, you can wear it around your neck, like a scarf or a dickie.
Yeah. Or a booty.
Yes, I guess it's like a scarf, but it could be a rug, or as you say, on the wall. Maybe that's
she's
what I'll
do with
mine.
She's not fussy. No.
If listeners are curious about what
to visualise
Gloria, they can find it on your Instagram socials.
Yes,
I guess.
Andy Dexterity. Yep.
Yeah.
Gloria has established a brand, I guess you could call it, called Gloria Gets Around.
Right.
Yes, she's one of those girls, if you know what I mean.
I know exactly.
Yes.
And Kate, you've got a crafty side as well.
I have got a very crafty side. I'm not frightened to admit.
No. You were just talking about, you know, the Christmas gifts for this year that you're about to get started on.
Yes.
You know, you've always been handy with a bag or you know, for a production, whipping up a large curtain.
When necessary, yes. I learned to sew at an early age. My grandmother, again, was of that era where people sewed everything themselves. She was also a very, very fine crochet person. So my mother was a knitter. I didn't want to compete with my mother, but I did take up the crocheting hook. And that's my real claim to fame, I think. I made a lot of rugs and hats during COVID, of course, to keep me busy. But yeah, look, I always like to make Christmas presents in the same way that you like to make your relish, Peter.
Yes, exactly. It's becoming tomato relish time.
I see those empty jars in the
corner. I haven't tried your relish.
Oh, you'll have to be on
it's
the
lovely.
List for
it's
Christmas
kind of spicy.
Party.
It's very nice.
It's wonderful. Yeah,
just
people
eat it.
Crave it.
Eat it out
year.
Of the jar.
They look forward to it.
They're lined up for
it. Does your spicy relish have a name?
With relish.
With relish.
With relish. You should do everything
with
relish.
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
Bring on Christmas time and the handmade gifts. I love
it. And if any listeners would like an order of with relish, you know where to be in touch. Now, Kate and Andy, you've had many collaborative partnerships on various artistic pursuits through the years. When did you first meet, though?
I met Andy, you'll have to think of the year. But I directed a musical called...
2007.
Wow, that's a long time ago. A musical called Altar Boys, which was about a boy band.
Bam, bam.
A Christian boy band that had a Jewish member.
Abraham.
Abraham, that was Andy's character. It was an absolute hoot, and Andy was in the cast for that.
Yeah, we met in a rehearsal room at the Seymour Centre.
Correct.
Deep in the dungeons.
Yeah.
And I was feeling a little bit too old to be a boy band member, so I put on a cool wig, and I really committed to it, and I kind of auditioned as a bit of a throwaway joke, but Kate and I really responded well to each other. And what happened?
I know, I remember your audition, because I think you did get really, really hot. I think you played the piano in your audition when you sang, and you got so hot you had to throw the wig off, and I think people were like going, what is going on? But I thought, oh, I love this guy. A, that he came in disguise, and B, now he's got rid of it.
Yeah, because I didn't have the mustache then, did I?
No, I don't think so. No,
pre-mustache. No, you were a cherubic young man.
In his attempt to age down, but it was absolutely fine.
Oh, we performed for the Pope.
The Pope came to Australia that year, that's correct.
I was
going
to say the Pope came to the Seymour Centre. No,
I wish the Pope had come to the Seymour Centre. Mm-hmm.
But people thought we were a legit boy band. We had,
that's the idea.
We had parishioners come and going, how long have you guys been a band for? And you don't want to break their hearts.
So,
it was like that, you know, that's what we did. And we've worked together. We did a couple of Mardi Gras parades. Mm-hmm. Andy did some choreography for that. You know, together we sort of wrangled thousands of people. That was a lot of fun. Andy's acted in a play. He was in The Ham Funeral at Griffin.
Ah, yes.
That was pre-America. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And when I was planning our production of HMS Pinafore, which you will remember, Andy was originally part of that team. Mm. He did actually end up going to America, but it was really great being able to start that project, you know, with a friend and an artistic colleague to get it off the ground and, you know, in the auditions and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah. Mm. The collaborative process is essential for theatre and making good theatre. I'm sure it can be fraught with difficulty, though, can it?
Yeah, I think collaboration means lots of different things to lots of different people.
Not our collaboration.
No, not us. We're in the same
lane. I mean, obviously, because you're back working again, you're on the same page in the same lane. Yeah.
Yeah. Look, I think that everybody that you work with, you connect with at different parts of their personality or different parts of their talent. I mean, it's a huge part of working in the arts. You can't do it by yourself, so there's always going to be a huge team of people.
Yeah, and our skill sets seem to be quite unique but complementary, and there's no stepping on each other's toes.
No, not at all.
Like, this is obviously a you thing, and And then you know when it's your time to step up and do a thing.
And I guess when we're talking about the opera, you know, we'll talk through the various scenes. And, you know, we're always really clear. I think this is going to be more choreographic, like, or I'll say to Andy, or let's look at the Queen of the Night's entrance. Now, we know that it's going to be quite a majestic moment. And, you know, the costume is quite specific, obviously, and we have a very clear idea of who that character is in our mind, and we'll collaborate then with Jessopina, who's playing that role. But in order for her to make that entrance, you know, Andy's skills are going to be really useful there to try and find what Jessopina can bring to the role and how that, I guess, connects with our vision for the role.
Basically, we play dress-ups at home and discover the show, so when we get to the rehearsal room, we already have a palette of options to show the performer and give them ideas to find it in themselves.
And Andy's got a really great gift of being able to get the best out of people in that situation, because often working physically can be quite challenging for people who perhaps don't often approach a role physically. Although, I mean, singing, for example, is an extremely physical act, but other parts of the body may sometimes be a bit left behind. But that's where Andy's a genius, because all of a sudden people find themselves doing things that they couldn't imagine.
Yeah, I think a scary word is dance to some people.
Yeah, dance and movement is just scary.
So if you just eliminate words like that,
yeah,
then they feel comfortable.
Everyone has to get off and on the stage. It's just how you do it.
You're a whisperer of sorts.
Yeah. And the body has shapes. The body can move in
it's
shapes.
It's a physical whisper.
Yes.
Physical whisperer. Cannot be heard.
I think my favourite story of all was we had one of the finales of the Mardi Gras parade. You know, obviously all the dancers who come are volunteers. People put up their hands to join, and we had 200 people in this finale. And we had a number of movement ideas that were going to work, and people often turn up and go, oh, I'm not very good, could I just stand at the back and clap? And we go, absolutely sure. But for the first couple of sessions, we're all going to be in it together, and of course nobody stands up the back.
We had
and claps.
A Trojan unicorn arrive at Taylor Square, and the original vision was we'll explode with the rainbow community and take over. We wanted a rainbow farting glittery.
I think it did open its heart, and there were some fireworks that came out, but we had to get up Oxford Street first with all our, I guess, our Trojans.
Yeah, but once we told them the legend that we're creating together, it wasn't scary anymore, because they just assimilated the legend. And then they no longer just wanted to clap.
Yeah,
they wanted to
be part of the story.
Wear the skimpiest outfit and go for it.
Yeah.
Well, the magic flute is a staple of the opera repertoire. Yeah. You know, it's been done many times. Ooh. How do you approach it, you know, like the Shakespeare plays, I guess, you know? Everybody's seen the flute or Midsummer Night's Dream many, many times. Yeah, yeah. How do you make it different and new for an audience?
I guess I would jump in there and say, look, the first thing is the magic flute is, you know, I mean, it's a really sublime work, and it does take a long time for us to get our head around what the story is and what the music is and what it is. It just seems monumental when you start. So the first thing to do is to try and get to know it, get to know the heart of it. And of course, it was only this time last year that I knew that I would be doing it. So that, you know, there's a lot of things that have to happen just to get inside that opera. But I guess I never think about how do I make this different or how do I put my stamp on it, because I think that is inevitable. The company that make the show will do that anyway. And you can really only build things from your own experience. So, I don't know. It's always story first for me. What is the story? It's a little bit, we were just talking about the Trojan horse. When people knew what story they were telling, it was a lot easier for them to navigate the challenges. So I think it will be the same with the opera.
And when Kate first mentioned the magic flute, which is a celebration in itself, because Kate's always wanted to create something for the opera house on a big scale, I had no idea what the magic flute was. And so I think not only was I a little bit intimidated because operas are big, but I love playing the part that is naive, because I'm hearing the story for the first time and I start deep diving into every production of magic flute ever staged. I research Mozart, and I'm trying to piece together this thing that I assume everyone else knows everything about. And I still to this day don't completely comprehend the story with clarity, which is exciting, because the process of making the show will be my mission to find the clarity in the end product. Because I think now, after we had a meeting last week, only now I'm like, oh, I get it. But I still don't get it.
We'll keep doing that.
I wonder if Mozart got it.
Oh, I think Mozart got it.
Did he?
Well, he got something. He produced something in his at 35 years old.
So you start with some sort of vision and then you prepared. Well, vision's a funny word, isn't it?
No, it is.
You have a feel about where you want to go, but be prepared that vision, for want of a better term, is going to be malleable. And depending on the team that you're working with, you're all going to shape it.
So I guess at a really broad stroke, we could say that the message of the opera is harmony. Harmony with oneself, harmony with each other. And I've extrapolated that further to go harmony with nature, because that's really at the centre of our concerns in the 21st century now, is how are we going to live in a changing world, a rapidly changing world? And because nature is, the death of nature is at stake with the climate crisis, I guess. So I guess that's, and the need for love and the power of love, and that the world is full of opposites and the surety of our own death, and that our lives are short and how are we going to live? All of these things and many more things are contained within the opera, like any great work. And then how do we manifest that on stage? I guess, well, part of that vision creation is what will it look like? Okay. And as you know, the summer season for next year, Linda Hume is working on Idomeneo and I'm doing The Magic Flute, but we're both sharing the same set. So the opera company is repurposing a set, a Michael Jürgen set for Werther from the 80s, which seems like a really great thing to be doing in these days when we're talking about sustainability and not spending as much money. And it's a fairly neutral set, but we already have some geographic and visual parameters to work with. So where Lindy's work is beautifully cinematic and actually uses a lot of cinema, The Magic Flute will be proudly analogue. And that's probably my real sweet spot as a director anyway. Mm. Being able to work with the nuts and bolts and materiality of our bodies and of our things around us. And the visual setting itself is, I won't give that away because people will need to come and see it, but it'll look quite different to say something like Idomeneo, even though we share the same set. But I think the audience will say, oh, it's the same set, that's amazing, which I think is quite exciting anyway.
But that focus on love and the environment and resourcefulness is making the whole process really exciting and important. It's giving the creation of the show some kind of urgency, especially with what's going on in the world today. Mm. And it kind of feels exciting to be a part of something that is going to be an example of a new approach to theatre in terms of using what we already have and doing it in a beautiful and, insert word, way.
Inspired. I'll give you an example. There's a very, very small scene in the opera when Tamino, the hero, discovers the power of the magic flute. He plays the flute and he discovers it has the power to calm savage beasts. It's a very small scene.
It's a bit like Jimmy in H.R. Puffinstuff.
They're all the classic tropes, I guess.
Have you seen Puffinstuff?
Yeah, H.R. Puffinstuff. Jimmy?
Jimmy was the boy that was stuck on this magical island, and Jimmy with his little flute that he had. And Winchy Pooh was always trying to steal the flute.
Jimmy.
Sorry.
Watch that as research, obviously. Anyway, there's a beautiful scene. It's very short. Where Tamino plays the magic flute for the first time and all these wild animals come onto the stage and are calmed and shown in harmony, and he discovers what the power of the music is. It's a short scene, but it's one of those scenes that you always go as a director, how are we going to do the wild animals? You know, how are we going to do the trial by fire? How are we going to do the trial by water? And that's where the real job of the director comes in, I think. Anyway, going back to sustainable practice, I guess, we are going to, and I'm happy to share this at this point, the design is a series of large animal heads but made out of cardboard. And we were in at the Opera Centre last week and we met Sergio, the prop maker, who had made a template or a prototype of one of the masks to have a look at. And it really struck me as it was an incredibly beautiful piece of work, but it's just so lovely to see the rough edges of a piece of cardboard, like something you might make at home, made with such skill by the artist at Opera Australia, and to think we're going to have the whole stage full of these beautiful animals that come out in response to the magic flute. I think it'll be a glorious scene. Anyway, we're looking forward to creating that.
There's an element of the Pied Piper there as well.
Yeah, a little bit, a little bit. Yeah, and then it becomes an issue of responsibility. So the character also learns about responsibility. So he has this power. So what is he going to do with it?
Yeah. Mm. Now, you've both created on a tiny postage stamps type stage, whether it be in your bedroom or the Griffin with the End of Winter recently. What is it like, given license to create on a large canvas, which is going to be the opera stage at the Opera House? Joan Sutherland Theatre.
At last. I love large stages. There's a good reason that, you know, stages are 10 metres by 10 metres, just what you can see on stage, and that's the size of our, I guess, our territory.
And for those of you that don't know, the stage extends way further back than the eye can see, which is also fun. Sometimes it takes you, you know, 10 minutes to get onto the stage.
Yeah. We're going to use that depth, actually, for one of our entrances. Look, it's great. It's great to have a space where an actor or a singer can run. I mean, that's always my dream is, can we get anybody to run across this stage? Because in the smaller spaces that we have in Sydney, it's very hard to do that.
Mm. And to be able to see a performer use the space gives a feeling of freedom.
Yeah.
And it also leaves space for the audience to imagine, you know, rather than painting every element of the canvas, you know.
And scale. I mean, we've got, you know, a large chorus. The Opera Australia chorus is, I think, 40 singers. So when all the chorus come on stage and all of the principals, that's a lot of human bodies. Mm, mm. And then you've got the orchestra in the pit. There's a great force that's coming off that stage. I can't wait. It's such a glorious feeling. Mm.
Did Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart create this as an original piece, or was it based on some sort of folklore? Or what's
he was approached by an old buddy, an old theatre buddy, Emmanuel Schikaneder, who was an entrepreneur and an impresario and ran a small suburban theatre in Vienna.
He wanted to be the star of a show.
Oh, well, he wrote for his family. He commissioned works for he and his family and his extended theatrical family to perform. And he asked Mozart if he'd write the music for his latest piece, The Magic Flute, where he would play Papageno, the birdcatcher.
It was a time of magical element shows, you were telling me.
Yeah,
there was
the
magic cup, the magic tree. And
people love magic.
Yeah.
So, it was and it's a singspiel. So there's singing and talking, I guess, like what we consider like a modern musical, except, of course, the singing is operatic. Yeah, so he wrote it as a commission. That's how it was done. It wasn't, the libretto wasn't written by his, I guess, most famous collaborator, De Ponte. But, of course, The Magic Flute is still one of the greatest works.
And full of tunes which are, as with all Mozart, immediately accessible. I mean, the Queen of the Night.
Yes. People will know the music even if they've never seen the opera. And, of course, one of the really startling little facts is the Queen of the Night's aria has been beamed out to space on a gold record as an example of
human excellence
the
creativity.
Height of our humanity's endeavours, I guess, when they send those, those spaceships out to find other life forms in the universe.
Should ETs find the record?
Should they be able to play it?
They will find a record player somewhere and listen to the Queen of the Night.
They'll hear the Queen of the Night.
And go, oh, that's a cool place.
Where are they going to get a turntable from?
I don't know. There's only two of these records that were made, and they were sent out. They're still out there, apparently, but along with a whole lot of other artifacts, images, and other
things
about humanity.
Those hipster aliens.
But that's a pretty cool fact. Yeah.
That's great.
I know.
Great.
Yeah, it's a good one for the...
But the show has, something for everybody. Every song is quite distinctly different. And different styles also.
Yeah.
You know, there's one of those songs and one of these songs. Mm. So Mozart's created a very rich tapestry of music.
It's a real mixture of the high and the low.
Mm.
So, again, the Papageno songs, people will have heard those, and they're real earworms. Mm. The music is not particularly complex because Schikaneder wasn't a great singer, but he was a great performer. So that's a role where you have a great singing performer, and Ben Mingay will play that in Sydney. He's like the voice of the people.
A lot of the songs will play the melody before the vocals come in to remind the actor of what they were about to sing before they sung it.
I guess that's why it was done.
That's why
because
it was
he was
done.
Writing for Mr. Schnickner.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
Now, remember, it goes like this.
That's exactly
and
right.
And when you know that, you can't unhear it. Then you know, oh, I see what he's doing there. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Not that Ben Mingay would need
oh,
any of that.
Absolutely not. We don't need
I mean,
to
he might rest on it.
So who are the other great performers that you've got delivering your flute?
Okay, so we have an all-Australian cast, which is also terrific. Stacey Alouem is playing the beautiful princess, Pamina. Michael Smallwood is an Australian tenor, an expat who hasn't been seen in Australia for many years. He's returning to play Tamino. Ben Mingay will play Papageno. Jessopina Gretsch, who I've already mentioned, is the Queen of the Night. Kanan Breen is playing the evil Monostratos. David Parkin will play Sarastro. Jennifer Black is playing Papagena. And who have I missed? We've got the Australian Opera Chorus, of course. I think that's everybody. That's everybody off the top of my head.
Dean Bassett and Nathan
Lee. Oh, yeah. Okay. Gentlemen from the chorus who will play the priests. Oh, and of course, the three ladies, Jane Ead. And we've got Indiana Schneider and Ruth Strutt. They're great roles, the three ladies. And we have three spirits played by two groups of three young children. And they are really a delight. So we have two teams of three and they'll alternate in that performance. And the children are going to really drive a lot of this production. They're going to be the trio that lift the curtain and create the monster that chases Tamino onto the stage and create that world of chaos into which we start. Yeah, it's going to be very exciting. Yeah. It's an ambitious idea, I think, working with the children in that way, but we're going to crack that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Have you worked with children before?
Yes, I have. When I directed A Cunning Little Vixen for Sydney Chamber Opera, that also begins with a group of children. They're more of a children's chorus. They always sing and work together. In The Magic Flute, the three children really are principal roles. They all have solo lines and important things to do, which are not just as a children's chorus. So it's a little bit different. But Andy, of course, has had a lot of experience working with children. So
being a school teacher for 12 years and then
absolutely.
Going on tour with the Wiggles for six. So, yeah, I'm excited to get back into that energy of
fearlessness.
Yeah, unlimited imagination
but
and play.
They know no fear, do they?
No.
Or what they can't or
no.
cannot do.
The thing that I learned about children was they always say yes.
Yeah.
You know, that's what we always want to have happen in the theatre world is, you know, oh, let's be giraffes in this scene. The children just do it. They don't even question you.
Yeah.
Where adults might go, why or how? And that's fine because that's what happens. But I think that's the beauty of this opera is that Mozart has written these parts for children to remind us that children can be very wise and fearless and that we must take that into our adult life. And that's certainly the sort of thing that I'd like to convey anyway.
A lot of opera composers do write roles for kids, too.
Yeah.
There are children in many, many operas.
Yeah, the sound of the voice is really unique in children.
I suppose it's a different sound,
so it's a sound
it?
World.
Yeah.
Britten's opera, Midsummer Night's Dream, which I adore, begins with a children's chorus as the fairies, and that sound is really it's sort of otherworldly.
It triggers innocence.
Yeah, it triggers all sorts of things, yeah.
Have you been into the opera house yet, in the opera theatre there where you'll be staging it? Have you had a look around there, or...?
On the stage.
Yeah, yeah. Have you been?
Only when I've worked on other operas. You spend a lot of time wandering around
the
stage.
So you won't really get there until Tech Week?
No, we don't get there until right at the very end. But that's fine. Our rehearsal room will be set up exactly as the stage will be. So,
do you have a set in the rehearsal room?
We'll have as much set as we need,
yeah.
Because we're relying on a lot of curtains and curtain action, and there are walls and then there is one side of the wall and the other side of the wall, we'll have something that represents that.
Kate and I will be going to the rehearsal early and playing shadow puppets for a few months.
Yeah, we're going in before Christmas to... So the production team at OA are going to have it set up so that we can go in there and, again, work out exactly how we're going to use the children to create the images that we want so that when we can really succinctly convey them. And also it's fairly experimental. And also then getting the lighting designer in and working together, because that's really the experimentation time. Time with the cast is always really short for production, so you sort of need to go in bang and convey the goods.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So how long have you got to actually build the production with the cast?
So the cast, the chorus, for example, are already doing music calls now, and a lot of that's prepared, obviously, in advance. Same with the wardrobe and all the props and everything, I guess, are being built now. The production calls start on the 27th of December and we open on the 1st of February. So I guess there is a month there in between all the public holidays that we always have in January. There's a month there and, you know, there are certain rules about how many calls people can actually have and so forth. But yeah, we've got quite a bit of time. It's a new production, so it has slightly more breathing room than perhaps something that's being restaged, which is great. But certainly with the chorus and the children, our time is really limited. So that's where we want to be absolutely clear about what we're asking them to do. I mean, the chorus don't have lots of singing in the Magic Flute. What they do have is very memorable, but we don't have any actors or puppeteers, so we're going to be using the chorus in lots of different roles. But I think the most exciting thing that we're looking to is the finale. I mean, when you get to the finale, you go, oh my God, it's over. But there's a great, obviously, you know, we start with the chaos, as I mentioned, and we end up with this beautiful picture of harmony. Yeah. And I think it'll be like a beautiful moving painting. I think it should be really glorious. Yeah. And really reflect on, I guess, our existence in Australia with the sunlight and the colours.
We're building to this climax of arrival and celebration, like we've once felt with the Sydney Olympics, where everything was great and everyone spoke to everyone and the world all came together. We're tapping into that energy
That was the most perfect fortnight, wasn't it?
It really was.
Yeah.
And we've talked a lot about it because we're sort of reminded of it.
Mm.
And the colour and just the way there was so much happiness. Mm.
Everybody smiles when you mention the Olympics. I've started wearing my parents' volunteer outfits out on the streets.
The pale blue.
Just to signal to Sydney that we're bringing it back. We can do it. I think once the Olympics happened in Sydney, we reached this mental state of, oh, okay, we've done it now and ticked it off. And in terms of like a global pride of being a city, I think, why not this summer, post-pandemic, you know, let's feel that energy again.
Public transport was exquisite.
The volunteers were wonderful.
Everything ran on time.
Everything was efficient because everyone was doing their bit and
we're
more.
We're on show.
Yeah,
that's right.
That's it. So let's be on show.
The world is watching.
We need to be on show again.
Yeah. This summer.
It can be, you know, events like that really mature a country. And we see it time and time again around the world, apart from the massive infrastructure, obviously, that happens around that. But yeah, it was a glorious time.
Well, I wish you both gold medals for this production.
let's go for gold.
of the Magic Flute. I can't wait to see it. Playing at the Sydney Opera House from the 1st of February to the 16th of March in 2024. My God, we're there already.
We are.
And what a delight it has been to catch up with Andy Dexteri and Kate Gall again five seasons on from when we first chatted. So thank you.
And you're going strong. Congratulations, Peter. Stages has really made its mark.
Yeah, it's good.
And it's wonderful.
It's good.
Yeah, look forward to it every week.
Thank you.
Thank you, Peter.
Escape into the enchanted world of the Magic Flute for a fabulous adventure. A noble hero and his lovable sidekick must rescue a princess in mortal danger. You'll meet surprises at every turn, and with the Queen of the Night pulling the strings, not everything is as it seems. Mozart wrote the Magic Flute for people from all walks of life to enjoy. A masterpiece of humanity and musical delight, this work has been globally popular from the Enlightenment era into the digital age. This summer, the Magic Flute will delight you with its big heart, adventurous spirit, and unforgettable music. The Magic Flute plays the Sydney Opera House February 1st to March 16th, 2024. Thanks for joining us in this episode. It's always an absolute delight to share your company. I'm Peter Ives. Keep well, keep warm, stay safe, and I'll catch you next time on Stages.